Everybody, my name's Mary, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. It's really great to be here. It's so fun to speak on Sunday morning. I really don't mind it. I kind of prefer it because I get to hang out with my host. I love this host system. That, you know, to come to a new town, and it could be in a city or it could be out in the country, and come to a new town and not know anybody, and within 10 minutes I have instant girlfriends. Now, that did not used to happen that way. There were a few instant boyfriends, but there was never instant girlfriends. And so I came here this weekend. Beverly called me before we came down, so I knew to look forward to. I knew I was looking forward to meeting her, and we got together. And as it happens, beautiful Becky and Katie came along, and we did what girls do very, very well, and that is shopping. And you have a wonderful town here, just a beautiful little town. I just love it. And you know, we wandered in and out of all the shops, and these girls were just so good to me. They should have been carrying me around on a sedan chair. You know, I felt like the princess that I truly am. But today, this is the Sunday morning meeting, and I know you are. If you are here, you are spiritually hungry. And I have a spiritual hunger, and it has been filled time and time again by coming into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get nervous when I speak. I get nervous because I'm excited, and I want to do well, and I want to see you keep smiling all the way out of this room. But I know that this is up to my God, and I'm not real sure what I'm going to say, but I know it's what I need to say. And see and share the love is our theme, and that's certainly what I hope I'm bringing to this podium today, because that's here. That's definitely here. The faces I see are the same faces that I saw the very first night I walked into an AA meeting room, and that instantly reaches my heart. It's those smiles I see right now instantly reach my heart. And so here we go. I told you I'm an alcoholic. I am truly an alcoholic. And the reason that I know that is because when I pick up a drink of alcohol, I cannot stop. And I lose control. And I found that out again and again and again. And it started with the very first drink, and it was that way with the very last drink to this date. And that's how I know I'm an alcoholic. I am powerless over alcohol, and my sobriety is all about power. It is all about the power that I looked for and all about the power that I received when I came to AA. But it's, you know, there was certainly, you know, nobody looked at me when I was 10 years old and thought, oh, that one's pegged. You know, she's going to be trouble. That wasn't like that at all. I grew up in a wonderful family, and I have a wonderful family today. I grew up on the west side of Cleveland and in a town called Lakewood, Ohio. And Lakewood, yeah, Cleveland's kind of a funny place. There's a river that runs right through the middle of it. You might have heard of it, the beautiful Cuyahoga River, that has not burned in over 30 years. And, you know, the east side of town is a little bit different than the west side of town. The east side has all the cultural institutions and the universities. And the west side of town is where we work hard and we drink hard and we go to Catholic Mass. And that's where I grew up. And I'm the oldest of seven children. And, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. And my dad, when I was a kid, he worked in television, and that was kind of cool. Yeah, you know, that was kind of a neat thing. And we had everything we needed growing up. Boy, we had shoes on our feet, clothes on our back. My mom's a great cook. You know, she cooked all that good Eastern European food and, you know, dumplings and pork roast and that kind of thing. And we went to Catholic school. Yeah, you know, but the most important thing was, you know, my mom and dad, they believed. And they believe today in their faith. They believe in God, and they offered us a God of their understanding that was loving and benevolent and kind and all-encompassing. And as a family, we ate dinner together every night, and we joined hands. And we said the dinner prayer. You know, we said, bless us, O Lord, these are gifts. And then we said the Lord's Prayer. And there were always some special intentions. Maybe somebody had a difficult math test, or somebody was trying out for the football team, or, you know, but we joined hands and we prayed together as a family. And that was important. And I knew God loved me when I was a little girl. In fact, I wanted to be a nun. My mom's best friend was a nun, and she, Sister Justina, would come and visit us, and I wanted to be a nun too. And I'd, you know, dress up on Halloween. I dressed up as a nun. And Uncle Joe, my dad's brother, he's a priest, and he had a parish about 30 miles away, and every couple of weekends a month we would drive out to the parish and run around, and you know, Uncle Joe would say mass and we'd be in the pews listening, and so it was just right as rain. It was to be part of this kind of a life and to have God present in our life. And I know there's lots of horror stories about Catholic schools, but that didn't happen to me. The nuns in my school were fabulous. They were terrific, and I knew God loved me, pure and simple. But as you know, we lived in a big old colonial house, and in the dining room there were these beautiful built-in cabinets, you know, with leaded glass and a nice window seat between them. And on the right side, my mom kept all her china. She had these beautiful teapots and china and mementos from different things. And on the left side was my dad's liquor cabinet. And this thing was, well, it was beautiful. And I know today it was beautiful back then. It was just entrancing. It was so gorgeous. And, you know, he remodeled it a little bit. It was the 70s, and he, you know, took all that beautiful leaded glass out and put in some fake plastic stuff that was really cool at the time. And, you'd open up the doors to this liquor cabinet, and he had some beautiful recessed lighting, and he'd flick on that switch, and it just sparkled. And there was every kind of liquor you could imagine and every kind of glassware you could imagine. There were big, fat brandy snifters and tall, skinny stinger glasses and rocks glasses and wine goblets and beer steins and all kinds of cool stuff. And he had all these bottles of liquor and dark rum and gold rum and white rum and vodka from Russia and vodka from around the corner Benedictine and what were some of the other ones? Strega, big tall skinny bottle with a branch in it. You know, that looked kind of scary. And the blue stuff. And my dad made a drink. You know, he'd come home from work and he'd hung out in New York in the early 60s and he knew how to mix a cocktail. Boy, he had a recipe book from the 21 Club, and when he made a drink, he pulled out a 3x5 card box and he had drink recipes. And he would pull out a drink recipe, and he'd get out all that stuff. You know, he had the knife that slid into the little cutting board, and he'd cut the fruit, and he'd pour the jiggers. And my brother Chris and I, we were the two oldest, and we'd have our little hands and our noses up on the table watching this alchemy. You know what he was making. Every once in a while, he'd toss us a cherry and... You know, better yet if it had been soaking in a Manhattan for an hour. But him and my mom would sit down and they'd enjoy a cocktail. Yeah, you know, with the beautiful glass pitcher and the stirrer, and they'd strain it out and enjoy that cocktail. And needless to say, I didn't follow that path. But, you know, something happened to me when I was about 11, 12 years old, and I don't think it's any different than what happened to anybody else sitting in this room or any other room in America, and that's puberty. I wasn't anything enough. I wasn't pretty enough, funny enough, smart enough, athletic enough, popular enough, anything enough when I was 12 years old. And the one thing that I wanted most in my life was to fit in. I wanted to be with the cool kids. I wanted to run with those cool kids, and you know, they were cheerleaders and football players, and I was always kind of klutzy and, you know, never made it into that upper tier of kids. But I was starting to venture from home, and when I was growing up, they were building the freeway, I-90, you know, that stretches east to west across the country, and it was right across the street, and I had to cross that freeway to go to school. And I was starting to, you know, push the boundary a little bit and hang out with kids outside of my neighborhood, and I'd go over to my girlfriend's house and we'd listen to David Bowie albums and talk about how we could freak out our parents. And I was walking home one night, and you know, at that time there were all kinds of bulldozers and earth moving equipment there, and while I was crossing the construction site, a bunch of boys in my eighth grade class jumped out from behind that equipment, and they chased me, and they ran me down, and they pinned me to the ground, and they sexually assaulted me. And I was about 13 years old. And then they ran off laughing and you know, high-fiving, and I got up, and I had no way to wrap my head around that. I had no way to understand what had just happened to me, but I knew it was horrible. And in a tiny part of my mind, I thought maybe it was because they liked me and I was pretty. And I staggered home, and I made a decision on the way home that I was never going to tell anybody about what happened to me. And I didn't have to worry about that, because all those boys went to school the next day, and they were happy to tell everybody. And they told everybody that I was a slut, and I was a whore, and I was there waiting for them. Nothing could have been further from the truth. So that was the reputation that I got to finish my eighth grade year with. And of course, we all went to the same high school, so it came with me. And after a while, I thought, why not? It wasn't too long after that that, you know, this was still the tail end of the baby boom, and there were a lot of kids in my class, and some of the other kids, they were altar boys, and they had a little rum-running operation going from the sacristy of the church to the local park, and I put my order in. You know, I thought this was going to be my ticket. You see, because what happened to me prior to then is I felt powerless. I felt truly, truly powerless. And I wanted that power back. And I was willing to do whatever it took to get that power back. And some of the kids, they were starting to experiment with drinking and drugs. And I thought, this is how I do it. And I put my order in for that bottle of altar wine, and I still remember exactly what that bottle looks like. I can't remember most of the 80s, but I remember exactly what that bottle looks like. And it was tall and skinny, and it had a kind of a homemade label on it that was peeling off, and it had some black just felt marker marks on it. I don't know where the hell it came from. But I turned that bottle upside down, and all of a sudden, that was it. I was the center of the universe. And I was the prettiest girl there, and I was the funniest and the most popular. And everybody loved me, and that lasted about 15 minutes. And the world started to spin, and I started to stumble and fall down, and then I threw up, and some kid put me on the handlebars of his banana bike, and he pedaled me home. Thank God. And he pushed me off in the driveway. He just pushed me off the... He pedaled away, and I stumbled up the back door, and there was my mother. And she said, "Oh, where were you?" And I said, "I was at a pizza party, and I ate too much pizza, and I threw up." She said, "Right." And she, my mom was no dummy, but she didn't know what to do with what she had now. She was no dummy, but she knew exactly what she had on her hands, and she had no idea what to do with it. And she sent me off to bed, and the next morning I had the first of 1,000 wretched, disgusting hangovers. And I puked, and I puked, and I puked. And I said, "Mom, I think I got the flu." And again, she said, "Right." And I was off and running. And guess where I went first? There was that liquor cabinet. A thing of beauty, glowing right there in the dining room. And I told you, my mom and dad, they were active in their faith, and they belonged to different faith-based projects and things in our church, and they helped others to come closer to Christ. And while they were doing that, I got a mayonnaise jar, and I made a beeline for that liquor cabinet and poured a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit. Stay away from the blue stuff. And I'm serious about that. Stay away from the blue stuff. And I poured it all in a mayonnaise jar, and I climbed up in the dorm room or the garage, and I taught myself to drink because this was going to be my ticket. I felt powerful for those 15 minutes, and I was going to get that back. And I learned how to babysit my brothers and sisters, and I learned how to drink and I learned how to do it without throwing up, without falling down. I taught myself how to take a shot and do all the things you got to do to be a world-class Olympic drinker. I had that personality change overnight, and I set out to master this art of drinking. And very shortly thereafter, I knew some older kids, and I got myself an ID. You know, back in those days, we didn't have pictures on our driver's license, and in Ohio, we had that yummy 3-2 low-alcohol beer, and I could get that. And, you know, when you're 14 years old, that's a pretty good feat. And so I had an ID for 18 by the time I was 14, 15 years old. And I got all that ID got older with me. And I was 21 by the time I was in high school. And, you got a little power going when you can trot off to the liquor store and bring back a fifth of a Black Velvet to drink at lunchtime in high school. And that's how it went for me. But the most important thing for me to point out is that I started to get angry. And I was the kind of drinker that, was always looking for action. I wasn't the kind of drinker that shut myself off and drank by myself. I wanted to be where the action was. And if there wasn't enough action, then, well, you got to make it. You got to make it. And in any event, I went to my mom. It meant a lot to her for me to go to the high school that she went to. It was an all-girls Catholic school. It was private school, and it was run by the Sisters of St. Joseph, and they were wonderful. I was there for 2 years, and they were really wonderful women and set a powerful example of service and intellectual striving, but while the other girls were going to the snowball dance and the father-daughter dinner dance, I was down in the flats that Tim was talking about Friday night, racing cars, racing muscle cars with my boyfriend and running from the police, the police would bring me home, or I'd be out all night, and there my dad would be waiting for me, and he'd sit me down on the bed and say, "Mary Margaret, we need to have a talk." And he'd start off on, one of his famous lectures, and he'd say terrible things to me. He'd say terrible things like, "Mary Margaret, do you know how proud we are of you? Do you know how beautiful you are to me and how important you are to your brothers and sisters? Do you know how much your mother loves you?" And I would just look at my watch and roll my eyes and tap my foot and wait to hear the sound of that 1969 Mustang 2+2 Cobra to come into the driveway. And as soon as I heard the rumble of that engine, I was out. I said, "Dad, gotta go." And I took off. And, every once in a while, he'd stick his head around the corner and say, "Why don't you come to Mass with us this weekend?" And I stopped going to Mass right after, by the time I was in eighth grade. I was done with Mass. The only thing those altar boys were good for was a bottle of wine. And so I was done with God, and I was done with Mass. There was nothing cool about that. That wasn't going to get me anywhere, going to Mass. And I was going to be free. You see, nobody was going to tell me what to do. I wanted my freedom. And I was at that Catholic girls' school, and I really wanted my freedom. And Sister Karen came to me, and she said, "Mary Margaret, I think it's time that you go to the public school. We don't think it's appropriate that you're here anymore. You're just not St. Joseph Academy material." And I thought, yes, because that's where the action was at. Lakewood High School, class of 1979. There were over 800 kids in my graduating class. And there I was with more credits that I knew what to do with, so I could get out of school at 11 o'clock in the morning. I could trot up to the Ohio State liquor store and buy a couple of bottles of whiskey and sit in the parking lot and be cool. And that's how I finished off high school. And Funny thing was, I did fine. I did. It wasn't that hard being in high school. I don't know if that's saying something about me or saying something about the curriculum, you know, I had my best girlfriends, and there was a big gang of us that just liked to do that. And all of a sudden, it was over. You know, it was time to graduate. And some of my teachers said, "Well, Mary, what are you going to do? You going to go to college?" And I thought, college? I mean, that's just where you go to party. I mean, it just never occurred to me that there was anything that you were supposed to do after high school. And so some of the girls got married or got pregnant, got married. Some of the girls got jobs, little secretarial jobs or something. And the guys went into the trades or got a job at the auto factories. And, you know, I found a job that paid me just enough, a minimum wage job, and I bought myself a fast car and saved up money till I could go somewhere because I had to get the heck out of that town. There was all I wanted to do was get out of that town and be free. You know, and still my mom and dad tried. Still they tried, and they sat me down and they talked and they'd invite me to mass and why don't you come to dinner with us, and they'd do that praying thing and I'd mumble and hold their hands and shove some food down and I had to go. And I was just off and running, looking for my freedom. And I went to California, and I went to Florida. And no matter where you go, there you are. And I'd find myself in a situation living with others. And I, you know, even coming from a big family where I had a lot of I didn't know how to live. I didn't know how to live with others because I was so accustomed to bossing people around and just making demands and telling, you know, terrorizing my brothers and sisters and, you know, I'm going to be sick. Get me a bucket. And I'd get to wherever I was and they weren't putting up with that. You know, so I'd be back in my hometown with my tail between my legs moaning and complaining about, you know, it was their fault. And, you know, I got another bright idea. I'd started partying at colleges, and I thought, well, that, you know, maybe I should go to college. They're pretty fun. And so I enrolled in Kent State University, about an hour outside of Cleveland, famous Kent State. And, you know, I decided I was going to study art because I really thought that I was the most unique person in the world, and I had a lot to offer. I had, you know, the world was really missing out on my brave ideas. And so I became an art student at Kent State. And at that time, they had a dormitory that was dedicated to art students. And it was a co-ed dorm, and there were guys in one wing and women in the other. And, it, you know, it was full of painters and potters and poets and musicians and architects. And drinking became performance art. It was a statement. It was, you know, I learned the fine art of drinking Mad Dog, you know, and this was my statement. It was easy to steal, and it was hardcore, and it was a statement. And I learned how to binge drink, and when I was in art school, and I wore a lot of black, and developed my cynicism. And I met a guy in my dormitory, and I liked the way he drank. You know, he drank martinis out of coffee cans, and he taught me how to binge drink. And we'd go off and walk the tracks and build sculptures along the railroad track and find a sewer pipe to sit in and drink Mad Dog or a half a gallon of bourbon and write manifestos, you know, about everything that was wrong with the world. And yeah, next thing you know, I'm flunking out. You know, next thing you know, I'm getting the report cards, and it's, you know, oh, I got a D in ballroom dancing. But this was the guy I wanted, and you know, that was the next step. Hell with college. This guy's my meal ticket, and you know, he was engaged to somebody else, but that was okay. That's fixable. And, you know, so before you know it, we're going to get married. And, you know, he's going to finish his BFA in ceramics. And He made beautiful art. And, boy, you think that Gordy stuff is pretty. You should have seen his art. And we were going to be itinerant artists. You know, we were going to have the big Catholic wedding, and we were going to invite all our friends and relations, and they were going to just, you know, shower us with money, and we were going to buy a Winnebago with all that cash, and we were going to hit the craft fair circuit. And, you know, and I had to live in Cleveland before we got married, and he lived in Columbus. We're both from nice Catholic families, and, of course, Uncle Joe, the priest, is going to say the Mass, and you know, so the family comes to town for the wedding. We have the rehearsal dinner, and, you know, I do what I do. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and rehearsal dinner's over, long over. But, you know, I do what I do. And, you know, I'm staggering out of there and dragging my brother out of the bushes and dragging him home. And the next morning, I had one of those hangovers. And I puked, and I puked, and I puked. And that summer, my mother had offered me her wedding dress. And I used to dress up in that dress as a little girl and be a bride. You know, when I wasn't dressing up as a nun, I was dressing up as a bride. And, you know, and my comment to her was, I don't want that. That's old. That's a rag. I don't want that. It's all beat up. I want my own dress. Now, my parents didn't have a lot of money at that time. My dad lost his job in television in the 70s, and it was tough on my family in the late 70s, early 80s there. It was real tough, but I wanted my dress. You know, so there I was that wedding morning, and I had that brain-splitting headache and retching stomach, and I'm wiping the crust out of the corners of my mouth because I've been throwing up again. I got my dress on, and what's waiting for me but my father? And he is, there's no other word for it, resplendent. And he's got the tuxedo on, and he's got the special cummerbund on. And I got to tell you, my dad, He was, you know, Bill used the word last night. He's a little roly-poly. He was round, man. And he had a round head, and it was bald. It was none of this, like, shaving the head bald. It was bald, and it was shiny. And he had ears out to about here. And he had a smile that went from his left ear to his right ear that just gleamed. He looked at me that morning with so much pride and so much love. And I'm, you know, retching a little bit. And all of a sudden I have the thought, oh, my God, what am I doing? But the organ's playing, and there's Uncle Joe, and the little 7-year-old brother shoots up the aisle with the little ring pillow, and there's Dad. So I walked like I'm dead woman walking. And I knew it was, I never wanted to run so bad in my life, and I knew it was a bad idea, and, you know, we got married, and I cried my whole wedding night, and not because I was happy. And I told you what the plan was. We were going to be itinerant artists, and what happened was my husband got a sales job, and we moved into a duplex that his mother owned in Columbus, and I was angry. I told you I had started developing that anger, and you know, I was the kind of girl that would show up at a party, and if it wasn't moving quick enough, I'd find somebody to pick a fight with. It'd be politics, or it'd be music, or I'd find somebody to pick a fight with. And if it could turn into a, you know, a push or a slap or a elbow by the end of it, that was good. That was a good night. And if it could turn into a real, not fists yet, but just a real shouting match. Boy, that felt good because I felt powerful when I did that. I felt powerful if I could call you names. I felt powerful if I could make you feel small. And so I was a little angry when that marriage didn't really go the direction that I was intending it to go. And, you know, my husband went to work on the other side of that duplex and started fixing it up for his mom. And there was a bar right across the street. And I did what I do. And I went over there. And that's where I stayed. And I forgot I was married, and I forgot about all my problems. And I spent my time in that bar. And I started to experience some physical problems around that time. You know, I was getting headaches, and I was starting to cry. And, you know, my husband and I were getting in fights all the time. And I went to the doctor. And the doctor said, he looked at me, I was 23 years old, and he said, "Oh, honey, you got stress." And he gave me a prescription for Valium, Tylenol 3, and Elavil. And he said, "Don't drink with these." I thought, fair enough. And 1984, I got nothing. Nothing. 1984 and 1985, I got nothing. I really can't tell you what happened, except for the anger, which by then had turned into rage. And my husband was a fabulous artist, and he made big sculptural pieces that hung on the wall, and they were beautiful. And it's amazing that drunk rage, the strength that you can find. And there was nothing more satisfying than to smash one of those things on the ground or to take something off the mantle and smash it into the fireplace. Boy, you're going to pay attention to me. And I started to run away from home. And I started to disappear for weekends. And I didn't care where I was going. Ohio's full of college campuses. And I was usually heading for one. And the first couple of times, my husband chased me, and then he stopped. And just shy of 2 years, I came back from one of those lost weekends, and I brought trouble with me. And he knew it, and he asked me for a divorce. And it was like somebody flipped a switch, you know. All of a sudden, he had the power. And I didn't like that. And I begged with him, and I pleaded for counseling. For him, so he would see my way. I'm dead serious about that. I had no clue. And he was having none of it. And, you know, he came back from work one day. It was, you know, in that time period of a couple of weeks, and I was despondent. And he pulled up, and we lived in an old part of town. The houses didn't have driveways. And so you had to parallel park, and I watched him park his car and get out of the car, and he had a big envelope in his hand, and it was my birthday, August 15th. It was my birthday. And I thought, he got me a birthday card. It's going to be okay. He knows it's my birthday, and he's going to come around. He got me a car. He's probably going to take me out to eat, and we're just going to move on. You know, all this is going to be over. And it was the dissolution papers, and he asked me to sign them. And something... You know, nothing ever had, the gradual progressive kind of spiritual experience doesn't happen to me. And it doesn't happen to me on the flip side either. It's always, you know, somebody flips a trigger and I go crazy. And a trigger flicked that moment. And I jumped up and I took him by the throat and I started to beat his head against a cinder block wall. And I wanted to kill him for making me feel this way. I wanted to kill him. To take his life. And he's bigger. He's 6 foot tall, and he was very strong. And I was no problem. He was able to take care of me in short order. And I was running around the house, and he got a hold of me, and he strapped me into that old 1970 Volvo station wagon that we had, and he chugged up I-71 to Cleveland. And just like that kid with the banana bike, he pushed me out of the passenger seat, and he leaned out and looked at my mom and dad and said, "You can have her." And he left. And it was a long time. I'll tell you, I was sober about 16, 17 years before I realized the depth of my intent, the depth of that murderous rage, that moment. I listened to a woman speak at a meeting, and she actually went to prison. And you know, all of a sudden, it kind of hit me like, whoa, I really did want to kill him. It was a long, long time before I really even identified with that kind of rage that I was capable of at that time, and probably still am today. But there I was in my old bedroom, and my softball trophies were up on the wall, and my Jim Morrison poster was right there, and my mom said, "Go to bed." That was all the same, you know. And I went to bed, and I woke up the next morning, and far as I was concerned, nothing happened. You know, it was just over. And there was my mom and dad just looking at me with that look on their face. And they just did not know what to do. Yeah, you know, and my dad tried to talk to me, and he said, "Why don't you come to Mass with me? You know, we've been praying for you every day." My dad went to Mass every day. And every day I pray for you to come back with me. Why don't you come? And there was a summer when I was a kid that I used to go with him. I used to go, and we'd be there at 7:30 Mass, and it was just, boy, it was wonderful. We'd sit in the front row and pray together, and it was wonderful. But there was no way I was having any of that. And by the end of the week, I found a new bar. And by the end of the second week, I had my bar stool. By the end of the third week, I was dating the owner. And by the end of the fourth week, I was a daytime manager, and I ordered all the liquor. I had arrived, boy. And I stayed in that bar for the next 2.5 years. I did not leave that bar, unless they threw me out. I did not leave that bar. I tried a couple other bars, but they'd always throw me out because I like to fight. And by that time, I was looking to make a scene. Yeah, you know, and it was easy to, you know, could always get people going if you insult the bartender, but usually it involved another woman or I was doing things like kicking bar stools out from underneath people. Because that was funny. You guys are laughing. I'm not laughing. You guys are laughing. But there's really not a lot to tell after that, except that it got worse. Except that it just got lonelier, and I dated this guy for a while. He was a lot older than me, and he had some money, and as long as he was taking me to where it was warm in the winter, and the best places to eat, or buying me a fur coat, or then I was happy. But for the most part, I wasn't, and it wasn't yet. Wasn't like he was the only one, I was lying and cheating, and as far as I was concerned, the cash register was my personal ATM, and there was just a steady flow of vodka, And anybody that came into that bar came in to see me, and if I didn't like you, you probably paid more than you should, and if I did, you probably didn't have to pay at all. I didn't care. And he was always, after a while, he was always breaking up with me, and I... It was a problem. I mean, I needed to stay there. And so I'd grovel for my job back. And, please, please, please. I won't do it again. It'll be all right. I mean it. I was drunk. I'm sorry. And, so I had my job back, but I was not allowed. I had to leave. He didn't want me back, but I had to leave at the end of my shift. So I'm banned from the bar that I work in. I had a problem with that. I didn't like that. And one day I got off my shift. It was happy hour. I worked a happy hour shift. And I got off work at 8 o'clock, and I was going to stay for one beer. Now, one beer, really? Seriously, was there ever one beer? I don't know. I don't think there was ever one beer. There was always another one in my purse, or those big boxes of wine. Those are always good. You could take them out. You put the whole bag in your purse. Get a big purse. Just lean over and pour it in there. They don't clink like a bottle. But I went down to the end of the bar. This fellow that owned the bar, he was down there talking to a young woman. I went down there and told both of them exactly what I thought of the whole situation. Well, there we go again. Y'all are pulling me out, throwing me out the front door. Went to another bar. Got into it with that barmaid about the songs on the jukebox. We got a nice fight started over the songs on the jukebox. And I called up some boys on the phone and cried to them for a while. And next thing you know, I was in the passenger seat of my car, and I was so mad. And I had my feet up on the windshield, and I stomped my feet and shattered the windshield. And I ended up on the living room floor of a girl that I knew. And I woke up the next morning. I went to sleep there. And I woke up the next morning. I was on the floor, and my head hurt. And I didn't know where I was, and it was cold outside. It had snowed. It was about 3 degrees outside. It was February 12th, 1988. And I woke up with the thought that if I took another drink, I would die. I woke up with that thought, and it paralyzed me. I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that everything that was wrong with my life and that was wrong with me was because I drank. And the reason that my parents weren't talking to me and my brothers and sisters were afraid of me and this guy had broken up with me and I lost my job again and that my friends were moving away. My friends didn't want to have anything to do with me, that I couldn't get anybody to do my bidding was because I drank. And the reason that my heart was breaking and that there was a hole in my gut a mile wide was because I drank. And I was scared to death. I had no idea what to do. I was 26 years old. And I knew one man who used to come into my bar, and he didn't drink. He drank Diet Coke, and he danced to the music like a maniac, and he drove me around when I was an idiot and took care of me, and he had more fun than anybody I knew. So I called him up, and I said, John, how do you not drink? Yeah, you know, I walked outside in that three degree weather and just, you know, what am I going to do? And I called John, and John came over and talked to me, and he said, Mary, what are you willing to do to stay sober? And I said, anything. I am in prison. I just want to be free. That's all I ever wanted, was to be free. And he said, well, you could go to AA. And I said, hey, what are you kidding? I knew a guy that went to AA. My parents had a friend that went to AA, and this guy, he was a real alcoholic. He needed, I'm serious. He lost his kidneys. He had to have kidney transplants. He was, I mean, this guy was, he took it a long way. He passed away recently. He's a dear man, dear, dear friend. But that, to me, was what an alcoholic was. You know, I had to lose a kidney before I was going to AA. And, yeah, you know, John was good. Yeah, you hear a lot of stuff from the podium here. You hear it. My sponsor said, you're going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Anybody would have stuck a finger in my face and said, you're going to 90 meetings in 90 days, I would have said, sayonara. And I'd have been on my merry way, and who knows where I'd be now. I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be standing here. And John just said a lot of things. You can get an assessment if you can go to treatment. You could try an AA meeting. You could try controlled drinking. I said, what do you do? He said, well, I haven't been to a meeting in a long time. You see, now this is the key. And this, my friend John, he'd been hanging around bar stools drinking Diet Coke, you know. And then along came me. And he said, I'll take you to a meeting. And he found his way back to a meeting. And we've both been sober ever since. And you know what day his anniversary is? February 12th, same as mine. A couple years earlier, but it was the same as mine. So I was all ready to go to my first meeting. And, you know, I did get one of those assessments at a local local treatment center. And, you know, they asked me all those great questions that make for such colorful stories from the poet. You know, do you ever wreck a car, lose your car? I said, no. You ever, you know, you have the bill collector calling you, you had a home repossessed? No, no. You ever been to jail? No. DUI? No. Has alcohol ever interfered in your relationships with other people? Well, and I knew, that second I knew the whole jig was up. It was up. I was powerless, and my life had become unmanageable. And later on that week, I went to my first meeting, and I found the first word of the first step that my husband spoke about so eloquently on Friday. I found the we. I walked into that meeting room, and everybody looked just like you, and they were smiling just like you, and just like you, and just like you. They were smiling. And they came in, and they're drinking coffee, and I'm like, I'm drinking coffee. And I don't want to be new. I don't want anybody to know I'm new. So they're shaking hands at the door. I'm shaking hands at the door. They're buying raffle tickets. I'm buying the raffle tickets. I'll sell the raffle tickets for you if you want me to. I have no idea what's going on. And they're talking about the big book, and I'm thinking, oh, it's Bible. Oh, what am I going to do? And I didn't know what I was going to do. And that first night, I heard the 12 steps. And I heard the second step. Came to believe that there was a power greater than ourselves that could restore us to sanity. And I thought, well, this is a spiritual solution. My mom and dad were right. And I took a huge sigh of relief because my mom and dad were right. And I couldn't believe it. I thought you were going to ask me for money. I thought you were going to make me go to South America. I thought you were going to make me accept Jesus as my personal Savior. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I was ready to stand on my head and spit wooden nickels. I didn't care. I needed to be free of the prison that I was in. And I was willing. And so I kept coming to meetings. And some of the, there was a, the, you know, I actually did get my job back in that bar. And I worked there for the first month I was sober. And I would work my happy hour shift, and one of the girls, she would pull up. There's a big picture window in the bar. You know, that was kind of my window on the world. And she'd pull up in that to that bar, and I'd throw my bar rag on the bar and say, "See you later, everybody. I'm going to my AA meeting." And they're like, "Would you just get the hell out of here?" And, you know, finally, and I'd, you know, run off to my AA meeting, and, you know, I don't. My personal opinion is I don't think a real alcoholic has any business sitting around in a bar for any reason, but I had to learn that, and I did, because about a month into that, I was looking around, and I was starting to get a little bit of that spiritual excitement. I was starting to feel like, you know, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked around and said, "I'm working in a damn bar." You know, it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and the regulars were getting going, and finally I said, everybody out. And I threw them all out, and I left the key on the cash register, and I called the fellow that owned the bar and said, "I quit." And that was it. That was it. But then, you know, those ladies, they said, "You got to go. You have to go to Edge Like Women, because that's where the real sobriety is." And Edge Like Women was a women's meeting on the west side of Cleveland that had been there for many, many years. And those women were really sober. They were sober a long, long time. And that, in fact, there was a woman I met there. She got sober the day I was born. And we like to think I'm the reincarnation of her drinking. But I went there the first time, and they said, you know, it was discussion, and there was the eighth step, and it was my first week there, and it came around to me, and I said, "Well, I don't know a whole lot about the eighth step, but what I think," and one of those women stopped me dead in my tracks, and she said, "Honey, honey, honey," you know, they call you honey there, or sweetie, "you know a lot about drinking, you're new, right?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I know a lot about drinking. I can tell you a lot of good stories about drinking." She said, "You don't know a whole lot about being sober, do you?" And I said, "Well, I've been coming for 5 days." And she said, "That's right, that's where you're going to sit there. You're going to be quiet and you're going to listen." And I, you know, I was horrified. My face turned all red and I was horrified. And they'd been talking about getting a sponsor. And I thought, I bet she's a good sponsor. So I asked her to be my sponsor. You know what she said? Mm-mm. She said no. No one ever refused me. And she had a good reason for saying no. She worked with my dad. She worked with my dad at the local hospital. And she'd been hearing for years from my dad. You know, and her own children were struggling. And the two of them carried that burden together. But she directed me to the woman who was to become my sponsor. And one of the first things she said to me, she said, "I am not a counselor. I will not find you a job. I will not pay your rent." She said, "But I will show you the steps." And she did. From the very get-go, she showed me the steps. And we started to work the steps right away. And by about 6 months, I had done my fourth step, and I was ready to do my fifth step. And my sponsor and I, we went to a park, and we sat, and I went through my first step. And you know, it's amazing how that step works. That step is a blueprint to me, those fourth and fifth step. That is my blueprint for who I am. And I found out who I was. When I found out who I was resentful towards and who I was angry at, well, who I was angry at, I was angry at everybody. You know, there was nobody not on that list. And I went through it with her, and at the end of it, she said, "Honey, you got a problem with men." And I said, "What?" "Yeah, you know," she said, "you might want to think about that." And we had a very honest, very heart-to-heart talk about respecting yourself and walking this path on your own in partnership with God so you find out who you are. And I said, but I got a date right after this. I had a date right after my fifth step. And she said, well, I'm not telling you what to do, but I'm just saying. You know, that's a great new catch-all phrase we have, too. I'm just saying. And, you know, but I listened to what she said, and my life started to change. Boy, did it start to change. And, you know, all of a sudden, I had a relationship with my family again. And I had that brother of mine that was right behind me. We used to drink together, and we went to college. We was at college the same time I was there, and we were kind of running buddies for a little while, especially when I was working in the bar. It's pretty nice to have a sister who's a barmaid. And when I quit drinking, he didn't like it very much. He didn't like that at all, and he made it pretty tough on me during those family dinners. I came back for family dinners, and he gave me a lot of grief. And then after a while, he just stopped talking to me. But, you know, my dad came back in my life. My mom and dad, it was tough with my mom for a long, long time. But my dad, we hooked up right away. And my dad, he loved AA. He loved coming to AA meetings with me. And he'd come to the big meetings. You know, he'd come to Big Orchard Grove meeting where Tim heard me speak that first time. And, and that we like to think of as the first real bona fide AA meeting. And my dad loved it when these alcoholics would join hands and say the Lord's Prayer together. To him, that was the most incredible miracle on earth. And think about it. Think about it. You know where you've been. You know who you are. Everybody sitting in this room. Yeah, you know, we could probably tally up jail time, we could tally up DUIs, and we can tally up the hostility and the contempt we showed to the people that we loved. And here we are, holding hands and saying the Lord's Prayer. How is that not a miracle? You know, and my dad, he'd hold hands and he'd just look around, be in the middle of a miracle. He loved it. You know, and he helped me out. I went back to college, and I did well. You know, I finished my bachelor's degree and did really well, and my professor said, why don't you keep going? So I kept going, and I finished a master's degree, and that was really terrific, you know. But, you know, what are you going to do with a master's degree? Not a whole lot. And at least I got a master's degree in communication. You know, what do you do with that? And so I got a PhD. They said, you can do this. Do you think I can do this? Sure, you can do this. And that appealed to my ego. I thought, well, yeah. I used to sit at that bar and say, I'm going to get a PhD. And I had an opportunity to do it. So I did it. And about a year into it, it was just about killing me. It was hard. Boy, finally, I hit the wall, you know. And I said, yeah, you know what? I did this to see if I can do it. And, you know, I'm pretty sure I can. So I'm going to quit now. And, you know, because everybody else is having fun. Yeah, you know, everybody else is going out and playing softball and going to picnics. And I'm like, I got to write a paper. And, you know, see you in about 3 years. And, you know, my dad would be right there. I taught. I was a teaching assistant. He'd grade my students' papers. You know, I was, oh, this one's not doing so good. You might want to have a talk with him. And I'd want to quit, and he'd say, what did I tell you at AA? You just give it one more day. Just a day at a time. One more day. Let go, let God. He'd start throwing those slogans back at me. I'm like, I got a sponsor. And so, you know, the time came when I really finished. It took me a long time, and I guess it was about 6 years, and I wrote a dissertation. It was a nice little, you know, piece of research, and I finished it. I finished, and I had to defend it. I had to defend it in front of a committee of professors, and I'd finished the defense, and the phone rang. It was my dad, and he said, oh, Dr. Stepp, you ready to come up? My last name is Stepp, S-T-E-P. Yes, it's really my name. I did not change it. He said, Dr. Stepp, he said, we're going to have dinner. We're celebrating. I said, don't call me Dr. Stepp yet. I still have to defend it. And I was going to ask him that night to come to my defense and be present in my defense. And, you know, he said, we're having birthday dinner and we're celebrating your defense, so come on over. And I said, I got to take a shower. I'll be right there. And I hopped in the shower, and by the time I was getting out of the shower, the phone was ringing. And it was my little brother saying, get here now. Because when my dad hung up the phone, he had a massive brainstem infarction. And he lost consciousness, and he fell to the floor, and my mom called the EMTs. And they took him straight away to the hospital that he worked in. And uh, he there was no way he was going to regain consciousness. And we did what he taught us to do. And my brothers and sisters came from the four corners, and we joined hands around him on that gurney, and we said the Lord's Prayer. That was all we knew how to do. And there was a little tiny piece of me. My heart was breaking for sure. And my mind was in chaos. And there was a little tiny piece of me that knew it was going to be okay. That this is okay. You're going to survive this. And that he was going to be okay. And that, in fact, he was okay. And, you know, boy, and then you guys started showing up. You showed up in the emergency room, and you were waiting for us at my mom and dad's house, and you were bringing turkey dinners up the driveway. And 2 days later, I had my defense. And my advisor said, you don't have to do this. And I said, oh, yes, I do. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I spent those two nights wailing on the couch and crying and beating the pillows. And what, you know, why does this have to happen now? And, you know, my husband's calling everyone, and they're like, well, how's her defense? Is she, what happened? There's good news and then there's not good news. And I went to my defense. You came. You packed my briefcase. You made me brush my teeth. You laid out my clothes, my green dress that I was going to wear because that was my dad's favorite color. And I went and I defended my dissertation. And I came back and he was on life support in the neuro ICU. And I whispered in his ear that he could call me Dr. Stepnow. And I smelled him. I took a deep breath and I put on his class ring. He had gone to college. He was the only one in his family that had gone to college. And I put his class ring on my finger. And I made sure that I never forgot, you know, that moment. And I turned him over. And the next day, we took him off life support. I couldn't go in there. I couldn't watch that. I just couldn't. I was too fragile. And Tim went there for me. And he said he'd never felt God so close. Probably till you turned your mom over. I know, I was there. And those are the times, you know, when God came close and God's never left. And neither has he. And I knew when we walked through that. Now, I didn't do it gracefully. I was a mess. I was a mess, you know, to the point where Tim was crying and begging me to go get some help because I was wrecked after that. But after I crawled out of that hole with the help of others and a program and a God of my understanding, I was ready. I was ready, you know. And every time I join hands, we prayed last night, and there was nobody standing on the other side of me. You know who was holding my hand? That was my dad. He was there, gleaming. You know, but I'm not going to leave you here for very long. My life is amazing. It is amazing, and I saw Tim walk across that meeting room, and let me tell you, I said, that one's mine. He was the most unattainable man in the room, and he had hair down to the middle of his back, and boy, he looked good in a pair of jeans. And I marched right up to him and said, I'm Mary Steph. And he said, whoa, he backed up a little bit. And then I didn't see him for a while. And the next thing you know, the girls were coming up to me, and they said, you know Tim Towsley? He likes you. And we talked on the phone for hours and hours and hours. I think it might be the longest conversation we've had to date. And then we went out on our first date. I couldn't even wait till Friday night. You know, we went out on a Wednesday night. He said, well, maybe you'd like to do something over the weekend. I said, how about tomorrow? And we went to a movie. We went and saw Stephen King's Pet Sematary. You know, and I grabbed his leg at the appropriate time. And we went out to get a cup of coffee, and I caught a vision of us in a plate glass window. You know, we were walking by the little shops, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm in love. And we've been inseparable ever since. We've been just inseparable ever since. Of course, I moved in 2 months later, and it was a disaster for 10 years. But we made it. We made it, and we learned, and it was hard. I am a selfish, angry, crazy woman. And but I had my sponsors, I had my home group, and I had these steps, and I learned how to deal with my rage. I learned how to, you know, this is all about finding the power. And I found the power here. I lost the power out there again and again and again. And I found it when I walked through those doors. God is my power. And I tried I've done all kinds of things. I've meditated with Hindus and sat in ashrams and made silent retreats and chanted with the monks. And the last thing I was doing was going to Mass. I wasn't going to Mass. I'm not going to Mass. Yeah, you know, and after my dad died, that left my mother, who I had a very difficult time with for many years. You know, things did not go well with her. You girls understand. You know what that's like. But my mom doesn't drive. 7 kids. She never got a driver's license. I think that's brilliant. I know a lot of smart people. I think that's just about the most amazing thing. But she needed to get to Mass, and somebody needed to take her. So I started doing that. You know, and I got to tell you that when Tim and I got married, my mom offered me her dress again. And I said, well, gee, I don't know. I'll see if I can have it preserved. Well, you know, I moved heaven and earth to get my big butt in that dress. And I have a friend, a dear friend, who's a skilled seamstress, and we moved lace around, and we changed the hem and the sleeves a little bit. And so the night before I got married, my dad was still alive, and we surprised them. And there was my mom's wedding dress. And I found a grain of rice from their wedding in 1960. And I wrapped it up in a little piece of lace, and I gave it to my mom. And that was the beginning of my amends to her, my real amends to her. Not the, I'm sorry, I was a jerk when I was drinking. Yeah, it was real, and it was with love, and it was pure, and it was honest, and it was unselfish. And, you know, my mom and dad walked me down the aisle when Tim and I were married, and it was the most pure moment of my life. I felt like a bride. And I met my husband, and we had, oh, that wedding was something else. It was packed to the rafters, and we did. We had the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer and the 12 and 12, and we had a big clam bake. You know, we have clam bakes in Ohio. We had a big clam bake for over 300 people, and we had an Elvis impersonator. Because it is not a party until there's an Elvis impersonator. That's for you, Jerry. I went to Graceland a sober woman, and I came out a changed sober woman. But you know, so there we were, and my mom needed to get to Mass, and I started taking her. And I found out as I sat in that church and I knelt in that church that I was baptized in, had First Communion in, went to 8 years of grade school in, got married in, and sat through my daddy's funeral in, and I know they're going to haul me out from, I felt good. And I felt close to my dad. I felt like he was right there with us. And it was pretty hard to get through at first, but then I started listening, you know, and the priest was saying stuff, and I was asking questions, like, you know, who, Jesus, huh? What is this? And all of a sudden, I had a desire to get to come to understand my faith as an adult, as a grown-up, as a person who had a spiritual hunger. And so now I still go to Mass with my mom, and I go there for me. And I don't have to do a whole lot of stuff. I don't have to join all the committees. Lord knows, the girls I sponsor are plenty, plenty. And And what I do now is I listen to what they have to say. I try to bring something home with me, and I listen to my mother sing. And she's next to me, and she sings those hymns, and it takes me right back. I remember when she sang to me as a little girl. And when I hear my mother singing, it's a prayer. And it's just, it's right there. There's my power right there. That is my God speaking to me. And that's what this is about. See and share the love. It's all around us all the time. It's not just coming from here. I'm just offering you a reminder. But it's gonna walk right out there with you. It's sitting right next to you right now. And God is in every one of us. And every time I look into your eyes, every time I stand at one of these podiums, I just can't believe it. There's so much God in this room. It's a good life. It is a great life today, and you know, I sponsor a half a dozen girls, and I love them. I like to work with the young people. I came in young, and I like them young. And they, every time they have a new insight, and every time, you know, they're growing up and they're maturing and they're learning how to be young women, and all of a sudden they're combing their hair and they're not wearing pajama bottoms to work, Mallory. And they're, you know, they're moving out and they're getting married and they're learning all those difficult things in life and they're staying sober. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Yeah, you know, my husband and I, we rescue these cats, and you know, we work way too hard, and you know, we're making it. We're just making it. And all of a sudden, I'm doing cancer research. Oh, how'd that happen? Yeah, you know, I ended up doing a postdoc in communication, cancer communication, and now I study and try to design tools to help doctors and patients make difficult decisions during advanced cancer. And I, starting on Thursday, and I'm launching a new study. I have my first interview with a very sick person on Thursday. And she's going to bring God to me. God's going to be in that room. And it's a wonderful thing. It's quite a life. So thank you, Cartersville. Thank you for sharing your town. Thank you for sharing your love. Thank you, Beverly, for being such a wonderful host. Jerry, for this wonderful conference, the rest of the committee who have, you know, I know this is a labor of love, and I know you all learn so much about yourself doing it. But I thank you from the bottom of my heart. So in a minute, we're going to join hands, and we're going to share in a miracle. And I hope you remember that. I love you. Thanks.